Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 9. I will call this chapter Job Replies to Bildad. There is no arbiter. Now, in this chapter, we're going to see Job basically agreeing that God is just, but he's saying that God is just, but that doesn't do me any good because he's not going to enter into a dispute with me to explain to me why he's causing all this bad stuff to happen to me, even though I haven't done anything to deserve it. So abstractly, God is a just God, but he's not giving Job justice here in this case because he won't dispute with Job. So we start now in Job 9, 1 through 4. Before we start, let me give you the context. In the last chapter, we have Bildad speaking. He basically says, Job, you should repent. And if you recall, Bildad was very, very hard on Job, saying that he was obviously a sinner and he needed to repent to get rid of all the bad stuff that was happening. It's not too late. Good things can still happen to him if he would just repent. Job 9, 1 through 4. Then Job answered, in truth, I know that this is so. But how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in 1,000 times. Wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm? Now in verse 1, Job answers Bildad. He answers him without taking notice of Bildad's harshness and unfriendliness, as Gil points out. John Gill also points out that Job will grant some things that Bildad says, and he will refute some other things. So we need to be careful as we go through here, because what Job says is somewhat subtle here in this chapter. He starts out in verse 2 and he says, in truth, I know that this is so. Know what is so? Well, Job concedes that God is just, as Gill and the NIV Study Bible point out. Bildad has said in the last chapter, Job 8:3, does God pervert justice or does the Almighty pervert what is right? And the answer to that is, of course he doesn't. And Job answers, hey, I know that's so. God is a just God. So that's not the issue here. As Adam Clark paraphrases Job, I acknowledge the general truth of the maxims you have advanced, Bildad. God will not ultimately punish a righteous person, nor shall the wicked finally triumph. And though righteous before man and truly sincere in my piety, yet I know when compared with the immaculate holiness of God, all my righteousness is nothing. In verse 2, Job says, how can a man be in the right before God? Now, he's not saying, how can I be right when I claim that I haven't done anything to deserve all this suffering? He's not saying that he can't be in the right about that. He maintains his rightness all the way through the book about that. But what he's saying is, how can man in general be righteous compared to the holy, immaculate God? Just in general, nobody can match up to the righteousness of God. So Job is acknowledging that compared to God, Job's righteousness is nothing, even though he was a pious and godly man, as Clark says. But Job is not acknowledging that Bildad is right concerning Job's controversy with God. Job is still relatively righteous compared to most men, but he was suffering much more than the average man. So Job never concedes his relative righteousness, but his absolute unrighteousness compared to God, or God's absolute righteousness compared to him, he does concede readily. Of course, you'd have to be a fool not to. Now, it could be in verse 2 that Job is saying, how can a man be in the right before God? Job is saying, look, if I, Job, can't be righteous, how can anybody be righteous? I've lived an upright life all my life, and if my upright life doesn't keep such punishments as I have suffered off of my case, then nobody is going to be righteous before God. How can a man be in the right before God? Nobody can be as righteous as I've been, Job says, and so that means that anybody is subject to punishment and subject to all kinds of bad stuff happening to them. He could be saying that, or he could just be saying, how can anybody be righteous compared to God, because God is the most holy God? But at any rate, Job is, once again, let's go back to our theme, he is saying that God is a righteous God, and God can do what he wants, but Job would just like to know why he's doing what he wants. Verse 3, if one wished to dispute with God, God cannot answer him, or the one who is disputing with him could not answer God once in 1,000 times. Of course not, because God is God and we are not. Wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm? Nobody stands up to God. And so basically Job is saying, I can't stand up to you, God. I'm innocent. I haven't done anything to deserve this, but I can't argue with you. We go now to Job 9, verses 5 through 7. It is God who removes the mountains, Job continues. They know not how. when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars. So now Job is just using natural imagery here to show how great God is. It is God who removes the mountains. That seems to refer to earthquakes. The mountains don't know how the earth under them started shaking. Whoops, what happened? Earthquake down there. When God overturns the mountains in his anger, who shakes the earth out of his place, that's earthquake. And its pillars tremble, just like the pillars of a house shaking before the house falls down. Verse 7, God commands the sun not to shine. That would be with either thick clouds or an eclipse. That could refer, of course, to when God made the sun go backwards in the Valley of Ajalon in Joshua 10, or the sun going backwards on the sundial in 2 Kings 20, those famous incidents. Of course, all that happened after Job lived. But so let's just take this. Who commands the sun not to shine? Who creates eclipses? And God sets a seal upon the stars, either by the light of the sun in the daytime, killing the light of the stars in the daytime, or maybe putting dark clouds over the stars at night. John Gill says this, quote, "The annual motion of the sun through the ecliptic, which makes the point of the sun's rising and setting vary, and is the reason why some stars appear in summer and are sealed up in winter, and others that are seen in winter are not visible in summer." In other words, the sunshine blots out the light of the stars depending on what stage of the annual cycle the sun's in. We go down to Job 9, verses 8 through 9, as Job continues to talk about the greatness of God. He, that's God, alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the ways of the sea. He makes the stars, the Bear, Orion, the Pleiades, and the constellations of the southern sky. He stretches out the heavens means he rolls them out like a carpet. That perhaps refers to the first creation of the heavens in Genesis, as John Gill speculates, or perhaps Gill speculates it might refer to God's continually stretching out the heavens throughout time. Doesn't really matter. God has stretched them out at some point. God treads on the ways of the sea. That shows God's power over the sea. That, again, might refer to the first creation in Genesis when God created the heavens and the earth and the seas and all that's in them. Or it could be God's continually ruling the seas throughout time. But it's a majestic image, as Clark points out, because God is walking on the ways of the sea, on the top of one wave to the top of the next wave. God not only walks upon the waters, but when the sea runs mountains high, God steps from billow to billow in his almighty and essential majesty. And then in verse 9, God makes the stars. Three constellations are mentioned, Bear, Orion, and Pleiades. The Bear starts in September, Orion is November, December, and the Pleiades is in the spring. So these three constellations cover the whole year. And they are northern constellations. And then to finish out God's majesty here at the end of verse 9, God also makes the constellations of the southern sky. Again, the whole point is to show how great God is. Job 9, verses 10 through 13. Job continues, who, God, does great things, unfathomable, and wondrous works without number. Were he to pass by me, I would not see him. Were he to move past me, I would not perceive him. Were he to snatch away, who could restrain him? Who could say to him, what are you doing? God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab. Now in verse 10, God does great things. Job is echoing Eliphaz here. Job 5, verse 9, Eliphaz says this, who, referring to God, does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number. That's exactly what Job says here. He's agreeing with Eliphaz, who does great things and wondrous works without number. Verse 10, Job 9. So Job agrees with Eliphaz on that point, at least. Job then says in verse 11, were God to pass by me, I would not see him. That emphasizes God's transcendence, his mystery. He's in a different world than we are. Job also says in Job 23, verse 3, oh, that I, Job speaking, oh, that I, Job, knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. Because God is transcendent. And especially in Job's pain, he was a little bit invisible to Job. So Job says, I can't see him. And then in verse 12, were God to snatch away, which of course God had indirectly done in the case of Job, God can snatch away temporal blessings. God can take them away at his pleasure. Who could restrain him from doing that? Nobody, because he's God. Who could say to him, what are you doing? Nobody, because he's God. Verse 13, God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab. Now this is an unusual statement here. The King James has, the proud helpers do stoop under him, with no mention of Rahab. So let's look at the options as to what this phrase means. Gill and Clark suggest that Rahab refers to Egypt, so beneath God crouch the helpers of Egypt. Now what we're going to see here is that whatever Rahab stands for, the people who are helping Rahab are helping someone or something in rebellion against God. In other words, they're bad guys. All right, option number one, Rahab stands for Egypt. Psalm 87:4, I shall mention Rahab in Babylon among those who know me. Behold, Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia. This one was born there. Easton's dictionary says that Rahab stands for insolence, pride, a poetical name applied to Egypt in Psalm 87:4, Psalm 89:10, Isaiah 51:9, as the proud one. So there we see the meaning of the Hebrew word means pride, the helpers of pride. Rahab can also mean a name used to symbolize the sea, as the NIV Study Bible says. That's because a mythical sea monster named Rahab lived in the sea, according to the mythology of the ancient Near East there. This monster was associated with Baal worship. Now, of course, the Israelites didn't actually believe in the monster, but he was well known to the people back then. And so Job, if this option is correct, Job is using the allusion to the sea monster to say that, hey, we got bad people helping this sea monster who is opposed to God. But God's over them because these helpers of the sea monster are crouching in fear and servility. The simplest way to take this is to do it the way the King James does it and say that the verse should be translated, beneath God crouch the helpers of pride. Benson, Barnes, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown take it that way, the Hebrew word meaning pride. So the helpers give assistance to those who carry themselves proudly towards God. They are beneath God doing that, proudly helping in their insolence the enemies of God, and God looks at them and will not turn back his anger, verse 13. These people are going to crouch, these helpers of pride. They're going to crouch before the Almighty God. We go now to Job 9, verses 14 through 17. Job continues, how then can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. Now Job in verse 14 says, how can I answer God? Now he never says that God is unjust. He's in fact just finished saying in the first 13 verses here, God is just, he's powerful, he's wonderful. He's not saying that God's unjust, but he's saying that God's not listening to him. He says in verse 14, how then can I answer him? There's no point in answering God. Say, God, why are you doing this to me? Because God's just not going to listen. He's too big for me. Now, again, we need to remember, Job never ever thought that God was unjust. He maintained his integrity despite his horrible trials. He refuted his false friend's contention that he was presumptuous towards God. He argued with them, as Adam Clark says. But he's saying, even though he hasn't sinned, there's no point in arguing with God. So he's just going to be quiet. He's not going to bother to put up a defense. He's not going to bother to ask God, why are you treating me this way? Now, he won't try to argue his case, Job won't, verse 15, but he does say, I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. He will ask for mercy. And then he says in verse 16, if I called and God answered me, I could not believe he was listening to my voice. He's so upset with God, he thinks God's completely abandoned him, will not listen to him. What's the point? And by the way, in verse 14, when it says, how then can I answer him? Job is talking about a legal answer. We'll see there's going to be a court case here shortly as we go through the book. And he says, how can I answer God legally? How can I choose my words before him? How can I make a good case? How can I lay out the words well? Now, in verse 15, he says, for though I were right, I could not answer. Now, he's not acknowledging here that he's wrong, that his case before his false friends is wrong. He's not saying that I have done something to cause this misery to come upon me. He's not conceding that. He's basically saying, even though I were righteous compared to God, it means even though I was holy and just as God is, I couldn't answer him. As John Gill says, quote, this is not to be understood of the righteousness of his cause that Job made no supposition of, but strongly asserted and determined to hold it fast as long as he lived. He still maintains that he hasn't done anything to deserve this suffering. But he's saying, even though I were completely right and holy as God, he's not going to listen to me. He could be saying, even though I were right civically and legally, in other words, even though I'm a good man and a good magistrate, I still can't plead my case before God because he's so much higher than me. Doesn't really matter what he's saying. He's saying that No matter how righteous I am, I can't argue with God. But he is not conceding his case that he has not done anything to deserve all this suffering. In verse 16, Job says, I could not believe that God is listening to my voice. Now that's sad. Now when you get to this point to make an application, when things are so bad that you feel like God's not listening to you, I just had someone who's going through horrible trials say the same thing from India. She said, I don't think God's listening to me anymore. That's bad when that happens. That's sad. As John Gill says, Job was a praying man who was used to hearing God answer him, and now God's not answering him anymore. Job is going through a dark night of the soul. He says in verse 17, For he, God, bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. That could refer to all of Job's afflictions, losing all of his property and his kids, as it could also refer to the sores and boils on Job's skin because he's lost his health too, if you recall. We go now to Job 9, 18 through 20. God will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness, Job continues. If it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. In other words, I'm right. I didn't do anything to deserve this, but doesn't matter what I say. God's going to say, yes, you are guilty. And though I am guiltless, even though I haven't done anything to deserve this, God's going to declare me guilty. Job continues to complain in Job 9, verses 18 through 20. And remember, the name of this chapter is Job replies to Bildad, there is no arbiter. He's saying that God is not there to judge his case. He's not saying that God is not a just God. He's not saying that God is not holier than Job and stronger than Job. He confesses all that, but he's saying he's not there to answer my question. Why am I going through this? Job 9, 18 through 20, God will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness. If it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. Verse 18, he will not allow me to get my breath, Job says. Here's some options as to what Job means. John Gill says that Job might have asthma. I don't think so. Another suggestion from Gill, the hot burning desert winds don't allow Job to breathe. I don't think so. Here's a third option from Gill. Job does not have time to catch his breath. He would not allow me to get my breath because one calamity happens one after the other. But he saturates me with bitterness. Verse 19, if it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. But Job is saying, look, I can't argue with God. He's the strong one. And if it's a matter of justice, who can summon him? He's the judge. Who's going to summon the judge? You're going to serve a subpoena on a judge? Verse 20, Job says, though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Now, John Gill suggests as an option as to what Job meant there, though I am self-righteous, my mouth will condemn me. I don't think so. I think Job is saying, look, even though I haven't done anything wrong, I'm righteous, but it doesn't matter. As soon as I open my mouth to defend myself, I'm going to be condemned in God's courtroom. Here's what Adam Clark says about this, quote, God must have some reason for his conduct towards me, Job is thinking. I therefore do not pretend to justify myself. The attempt to do it would be an insult to his majesty and justice. So in other words, though I am righteous and haven't done anything wrong, it would be an insult. My mouth would condemn me if I tried to defend myself. It would insult God's majesty and justice. Clark continues, though I am conscious of none of the crimes of which you accuse me and know not why he contends with me, yet he must have some reason, and for that reason he does not choose to explain. So Job is still maintaining his innocence in his cause. He didn't do anything to deserve this mess. Job says, though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. Now, of course, that can mean he's guiltless in the sense that even if he was completely without sin, which of course nobody is, but he could be stating that as an extreme case, even though I was perfectly innocent and righteous, God would still declare him guilty. But I don't think that's what he's saying. I think Job is saying, though I am guiltless of anything to cause this suffering, nonetheless, God is going to declare me guilty. Now, he's getting awful close to starting to deny God's justice, I must say. I mean, we've said over and over again, he never did that, but he's coming close. And I guess you could get around that by saying that, no, he's not saying that even though he's not guilty of anything to cause the suffering, God would nevertheless declare him guilty. That would be denying God's justice. But if you take the guiltless as I am, even though I were perfectly forensically, legally innocent of any and all sin, in other words, if I was just as perfect as Adam, nonetheless, God would declare me guilty. he would be speaking hyperbolically. He would not be confessing his sin. Adam Clark points out that almost all the terms from Job chapter 9, verses 11 through 24 are forensic and judicial. So basically, Job is saying, hey, even though I'm forensically innocent, legally innocent, even if I were such, which I'm not, then God would still be able to declare me guilty. We go down to Job 9, let's finish verse 20 first. Job says, though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. What does he mean by that? Well, I think what he means is, if Job were foolish enough to claim his innocence before God, his own words, Job's own words, in doing so, would condemn him, because his words would be preposterously wrong, even though I am perfectly, legally, forensically righteous. Now, you see what the problem in interpreting these verses are. When Job says he's righteous, what is he talking about? Is he talking about perfect righteousness like Adam had before the fall? Or is he talking about righteous in my case that I haven't done anything to deserve all this suffering? We're going to take it the way Adam Clark takes it. We're going to take Job as saying, even though I am perfectly righteous, my mouth would still condemn me because God, he controls the courtroom and he's not giving me a hearing. We're not going to take it as saying that Job is saying, even though I'm righteous in my case and controversy before God right now and have not done anything to deserve all this suffering, God will declare me guilty anyway for that, because then he would be denying the justice of God, and I have trouble believing that. We go now to Job 9, verses 21 through 24. Though I am blameless, I no longer care about myself. I renounce my life. It is all the same. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is handed over to the wicked. He blindfolds its judges. If it isn't he, then who is it? Some translations have verse 21 saying, I am blameless, but the Holman Christian Study Bible and the KJV have, even though I am blameless, which makes it a hypothetical situation. He is not saying he's perfectly blameless. But even if he were perfectly blameless, he doesn't care anymore. And of course, that would be, again, you got the same problem. Is that blameless, perfectly blameless, or does it mean blameless in causing something to bring about all this suffering? But either way, Job says, I don't care about myself. I renounce my life. He's just given up. He just said that God's not going to give me a hearing in his court. He's not explaining this to me. I don't know what's going on, so I just give up. I quit. Verse 22, he says, it's all the same. In other words, whether I'm blameless or not blameless, whether I did something to deserve this or whether I didn't do something to deserve this, it's all the same. Because God says, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. Doesn't make any difference. Now, here's something to discuss here. Is Job speaking blasphemy now? Is he so worn down and in despair he says there's no justice in God? We've been saying that Job has not denied the justice of God yet, but now it sounds like he is. He destroys both the blameless and the wicked. The NIV Study Bible says that in his despair, Job paints a horrifying and incorrect picture of God. Well, if he does that, then he's denying the justice of God, which we said that he hasn't done. So is there another option here besides saying that Job is committing blasphemy? What if he's stating the truth? God destroys both the blameless and the wicked? Well, how about in the time of Jeremiah after the fall of the kingdom of Judah, 586 BC, when Babylon wiped out Jerusalem? Jeremiah's good figs were taken to Babylon just like the bad figs were. Jeremiah 24:2. One basket had very good figs, like first ripe figs, and the other basket had very bad figs, which could not be eaten due to rottenness. So was the righteous remnant guilty of some great sin because they were taken to Egypt just like the bad guys were? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fire. Were they guilty of some great sin to have other people, to have them thrown into the fire where other people were spared? Now, of course, you could say, well, they were spared too at the end, but still they had to go through the fire. So Job is really right when he says that God destroys both the blameless and the wicked because bad things happen to good people. Job is saying here, according to this view, is that you can't judge one spiritual state by outward circumstances because the blameless and the wicked both get destroyed at times. Now, there are some counterexamples. Noah, of course, was righteous and he was saved, righteous Noah. You just can't make a rule about it. You can't make a rule about disaster and say disaster means sin. Blessing means, or prosperity means, righteousness. Some of the most prosperous nations in the world, like Japan, they don't believe in God. They don't believe in Jesus. Now, in verse 24, when Job says that God blindfolds the judges of the world and the earth is handed over to the wicked. Does not sound like America. You got the CIA, the FBI, it's corrupt. God is doing that? That's just like when we say there's no justice in the world. It's a terrible thing when you get to the point where there's no justice in the world. So Job is getting really, really sad here. He's saying there's no justice here. Where's God? I can't get a hearing in court. I don't understand why I can't get justice. We go now to Job 9, verses 25 through 28. Job continues, "Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They slip by like reed boats, like an eagle that swoops on its prey. Though I say I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my sad countenance and be cheerful. I am afraid of all my pains. I know that thou wilt not equip me." King James English sneaked into my New American Standard Bible translation. "Now my days are swifter than a runner," verse 25. A runner is a courier on the post roads, and of course they ran all the time to carry the mail. They go by fast, just like our days. Job is saying our days are flying away. I'm not going to see justice. "The days slip by like reed boats." Reed boats were lightly built boats made out of reeds, and they were very, very fast. Just like an eagle that swoops on its prey, that's fast too. The days are going. Verse 27, "Though I say I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my sad countenance and be cheerful." It's real easy to say you're going to be cheerful, but to actually do it. Verse 28, he says, "Even though I say I'm going to be cheerful, I am afraid of all my pains." The NIV says, "I still dread all my pains." Job is still afraid his sufferings will continue. And they do. They do continue. Because Job says, "I know that you're not going to acquit me." Now, that doesn't mean he was afraid of going to hell. John Gill says Job did not despair of his everlasting salvation, but rather Job is afraid that God will not relieve him from his temporal pain. "I am afraid of all my pains." He's also probably afraid that God will not acquit him in the eyes of his false friends as well, the emotional pain that that caused. We go now to Job 9, verses 29 through 31. Job continues, "Since I will be found guilty, why should I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, then you dip me in a pit of mud and my own clothes despise me." So verse 29, Job is saying, look, if you're going to find me guilty, why should I labor in vain to prove my innocence? There's no point. As Adam Clark and John Gill say, if he was as evil as his friends said he was, there was no use in praying for forgiveness. That's the easiest way to take it. You could take it this way, since I will be found guilty because I'm a sinner like all human beings are, God's not going to forgive me because he's not going to forgive all sinners in the world. No, I think he's talking about his alleged sin that's caused all the suffering that he's going to be found guilty of by his friends. So Job is submitting here. He says, okay, you're going to find me guilty, God. But as Barnes says, Job submits not so much because he is convinced that God is right as because God is powerful and he weak. So Job sort of submits to God like a tyrant. Job says, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. You're not going to listen to me. Verse 30, if I wash myself with snow, as John Gill says, snow was kept in vessels for such use, for washing, as being judged the best for such a purpose. So it was used by the ancients as being what whitens the skin and strengthens the parts by contracting the pores and hindering perspiration. The NIV footnote has soap. If I wash myself with soap, I like snow better. Jameson Fawcett Brown says snow was thought to cleanse better than common water. Washes himself with snow, cleanses his hands with lye. He says, then I do all that. And then verse 31, then you, God, dip me in a pit of mud. As John Gill says, in the filthy ditch of sin, the pit wherein is no water, the horrible pit, the mire and clay in which all unregenerate men are and to which hypocrites return, as the swine to its wallowing in the mire. In other words, God, you're going to deem me guilty. You're going to deem me guilty of something I've done when I haven't done anything. In verse 31, my own clothes despise me like a leper's clothes. Leper's clothes are afraid to touch the body because they would catch the disease. So Job once again expresses his despair at getting justice from God or an explanation from God as to why he's suffering. We go now to Job 9, verses 32 through 35. Job continues, for he, God, is not a man like me that I can answer him, that we can take each other to court. There is no one to judge between us, to lay his hand on both of us. Let him take his rod away from me so his terror will no longer frighten me. Then I would speak and not fear him. But that is not the case. I am on my own. Now, in verse 32, when Job says, "For he is not a man like me that I can answer him," he's talking about answer in a judicial sense. We still call that today in modern law. You got a petition, summons, and complaint, or a petition, and then the defendant answers. That's a technical legal term. And that's what Job is talking about here. He's saying, if he takes me to court, I can't answer him because he's God. He's not a man like me. Ecclesiastes 6:10 says, "Whatever exists has already been named. It is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is." Again, Job is saying, "You're stronger than me, God. I don't know why this has happened to me, and you're not explaining it to me, but I'm going to submit to you merely because you're bigger than me." Isaiah 45:9, first part of the verse, "Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker, an earthenware vessel among the vessels of earth. Will the clay say to the potter, 'What are you doing?'" So Job is saying, hey, I can't answer God. And then in verse 33, he says, "There's no one to judge between us, to lay his hand on both of us, an arbitrator or a judge can grab both the plaintiff and defendant and crack their heads together and say, 'Work it out.'" But not so with Job, no one to judge. Verse 34, "Let him take his rod away from me." A rod, of course, is a symbol of power, like a ruler's scepter. It's a symbol of punishment. Job feels like he's being punished here. He's not, but he feels like he is. He says, "If that all this bad stuff was taken away from me, then I would speak and not fear God. But that's not the case. I'm on my own. Nobody's representing me. I don't have counsel. I don't have a lawyer to defend myself against God." So poor old Job, he knows he's innocent, but he can't figure out why God has done this to him, and he doesn't think that God's ever going to explain it to him in his heavenly courtroom. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Job chapter 9. This prepares us to go to Job chapter 10 in our next audio, verses 1 through 22, and we will entitle that audio, "Job Continues, A Plea to God." So ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.